So you never answered my question, Lugo says, Skull steering him into the rear of the cruiser. You ever been locked up before? The kid turns his head away, murmurs something. It's okay, you can tell me. Said, yes. For? The kid shrugs, embarrassed, says this. Yeah, around here? Uh-huh. How long back? On Christmas Eve. On Christmas Eve for this? Lugo winces. That is cold. Who the fuck? Do you remember who collared you? Uh-huh. The kid mutters, then looks Lugo in the face. You.
Welcome to Book Tour. I am Netta Ulaby. Richard Price is a crime writer with a knack for capturing the rhythms and language of today, much as Mickey Spillane did in the 1950s. His new book, Lush Life, takes a hard-boiled look at Manhattan hipsters and the lawlessness lurking behind the veneer of their trendy New York neighborhoods. Richard Price has written 8 novels, including Freedomland and Clockers, which was adapted to the screen by Spike Lee. Price also wrote the screenplay for The Color of Money and some award-winning episodes of the HBO show The Wire. Richard Price, born in the Bronx, has said that growing up, he never thought he could write about his home borough because no one would be interested. What changed his mind? Hubert Selby Jr.'s novel, Last Exit to Brooklyn. Like Selby, Price is celebrated for his gritty urban authenticity. This reading of Lush Life was recorded in April 2008 at the Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C. A warning to our listeners, some of the language in this reading may be too gritty for some.
I've been hearing that word gritty since 1974. I just feel like I'm something like stuck between somebody's teeth or... Okay, I'm going to read for 20, 25 minutes. No more, I swear. The book's about the Lower East Side of New York, and because we're so close to New York, I'm not going to get a hernia trying to describe the Lower East Side. Except it's about a homicide that takes place there between the two of the worlds down there, between the influx of the 20-ish sort of La Bohemers that are running in the neighborhood and some of the projects people who didn't get the message, you're not supposed to be there anymore. The neighborhood actually has gone from being one of the most dangerous in the city when Dinkins was mayor to when Giuliani took over and imposed Giuliani time, which is anybody so much as lights up a menthol cigarette, lock them up. And the fact that real estate needed a place to go, real estate being the greatest crime fighter, it's become, you know, one of the safest. But you still have to make your arrest because you can't submit a report from the precinct to One Police Plaza with no arrest. So they've created a squad called the Quality of Life Squad, and they're basically out there to manufacture arrests. And what they do is they sit on the Delancey Street where the Williamsburg Bridge takes cars from Brooklyn, empties out into the Lower East Side, and basically it's racial profiling. And this is one of the arrests that the Quality of Life Squad makes. So the Quality of Life, it's like 900 pounds of white meat with guns in a taxi that fools no one. And the names you'll hear are Lugo, Daly, Gehagen, and Scharf. And the two kids that they stopped, their names are seriously and fucked. So they're just cruising Delancey. It's about 11 o'clock at night. And they're just looking for a collar. Hang on. Scharf abruptly perks up, his head on a swivel. That there looks good. High beams going west. 4 bodies. Going west? Lugo floors it in heavy traffic. Think thin, girls, as he takes the driver's side wheels up onto the concrete divider to get past a real cab waiting for the light, then whips into a U-turn to get abreast of the target car, peering in. Females, 2 mommies, 2 kids, passing them, hungrier now, all of them. Then Scharf ahoying once again. Green Honda, going east. Now east, he says. Lugo does another 180 and pulls behind the Honda. All right, what do we got? 2 males in the front. What do we got? Neon trim on the plate. Tinted windows, right rear taillight. Front passenger, just stuff something under the seat. Thank you. Lugo hits the misery lights, climbs up the Honda's back, the driver taking half a block to pull over. Daly and Lugo slowly walk up on either side of the car, cross-beam the front seats. The driver, a young green-eyed Latino, rolls down his window. Officer, what'd I do? Lugo rests his cross arms on the open window as if it's a backyard fence. License and registration, please. For real, what'd I do? You always drive like that? His voice almost gentle. Like what? Signaling lane changes, all road courteous and shit. Excuse me? Come on, nobody does that unless they're nervous about something. Well, it was. Nervous? You was following me. A cab was following you? Yeah, okay, a cab. Passing over his papers. All serious, officer, no disrespect intended. Maybe I can learn something here, but what did I do? Primary, you have neon trim on your plates. Hey, I didn't put it there. This is my sister's whip. Secondary, your windows are too dark. I told her about that. Tertiary, you crossed a solid yellow to get around a double-parked car. Quadrary, you're sitting by a hydrant. That's because you just pulled me over. Lugo takes a moment to assess the level of mouth he's getting. As a rule, he is soft-spoken, leaning into the driver's window to conversate, to explain. His expression baggy with patience, going eye to eye as if to make sure what he's explicating here is being digested. Seemingly deaf to the obligatory sputtering, the misdemeanors of verbal abuse. But if the driver says that one thing, goes one word over some invisible line, then without any change of expression, without any warning signs, except maybe a slow straightening up, a sad, disgusted looking off, he steps back, reaches for the door handle, and the world as they knew it is no more. But this kid isn't too bad. This is for your own benefit. Get out of the car, please. As Lugo escorts the driver to the rear bumpers, Daly leans into the shotgun seat window and tilts his chin at the passenger, the second kid sitting there affecting comatosity, heavy-lidded under a too-big baseball cap and staring straight ahead as if they were still driving somewhere. So it's your story, Daly says, opening the passenger door, offering this one some sidewalk too, as Gehagen, all tatted out in Celtic braids, knots, and crosses, leans in to search the glove compartment, the cup caddy, the tape storage bin, Scharf taking the rear seats. Back at the bumpers, the driver stands in a scarecrow tee, looking off soul-eyed as Lugo, squinting through his own cigarette smoke, finger walks his pockets, coming up with a fat roll of 20s. It's a lot of cheddar, cuz. Counting it, then stuffing it in the kid's shirt pocket before continuing to pat down. Yeah, well, that's my college tuition money. What the fuck? College takes cash, Lugo laughs, then finished gestures to the bumper. Have a seat. Burke Technical in the Bronx, it's new. And they take cash? Money's money. True that, Lugo shrugs, just waiting out the car search. So what's your major? Furniture management? You ever been locked up before? Come on, man, my uncle's like a detective in the Bronx. Like a detective? No, a detective. He just retired. Oh, yeah? What precinct? I don't know, per se. The 69th? The fighting 69th, Gehagen calls out, feeling under the passenger seat now. There is no 69th, Lugo says, flicking his butt into the gutter. 60-something, I said I wasn't sure. What's his name? Rodriguez? Rodriguez in the Bronx? That narrows it down. What's his first name? Narciso? Don't know him. Had a big retirement party? Sorry. I've been thinking of trying out for the police academy myself. Oh, yeah, that's great. Hey, Donnie. Gehagen backs out of the passenger door, holds up a Ziploc of weed, because we need more fucking smoke hounds. The kid closes his eyes, tilts his chin to the stars, to the moon over Delancey. His or yours? Lugo gestures to the other kid on the sidewalk, face still blank as a mask, his pockets strewn over the car hood. Somebody needs to say, or you both go. Mine, the driver finally mutters. Turn around, please. Are you going to lock me up for that? Hey, 2 seconds ago you stepped up like a man. Stay with that. Lugo cuffs him, then turns him forward again, holding him at arm's length as if to assess his outfit for the evening. Anything else in there? Tell us now, we'll rip that hoopty to shreds. Damn, man, I barely had that. All right, then, just relax, guiding him back down to the bumper again as the search continues. The kid looks off, shakes his head, mutters, sorry ass. Excuse me? No, I'm just saying. Purse in his mouth. Not about you. Gehagen comes back with the baggie, hands it over. Okay, look. Lugo lights another cigarette, takes a long first drag. This? We could give a fuck. We're out here on a higher calling. He nods at a passing patrol car, something the driver said making him laugh. You know what I'm saying? More serious shit? There you go. That's all I got. I'm not talking about what you got. I'm talking about what you know. What I know? You know what I'm saying. They both turn and look off in the direction of the East River, two guys having a moment, one with his hands behind his back. Finally, the kid exhales heavily. Well, I can tell you where a weed spot is. You're kidding me, right? Lugo rears back. I'll tell you where a weed spot is. I'll tell you where 50 is. I can get you better shit than this for half what you paid 7 days a week with blindfolds on. The kid sighs, tries not to look at the barely curious locals coming out of the Banco de Ponce ATM Center and the Dunkin' Donuts. The college kids hopping in and out of taxis. Come on, do right by me, I'll do right by you. Lugo absently tosses the baggie from hand to hand, drops it, picks it up. Do right like how? I want a gun. A what? I don't know a gun. You don't have to know a gun, but you know someone who knows someone, right? Aw, man. For starters, you know who you bought this shit from, right? I don't know any guns, man. You got $40 of weed there. I paid for it with my own money because it helps me relax, helps me party. Everybody I know is like, go to work, go to school, get high, that's it. Huh, so like there's no one you could call, say, yo, I just got jacked into PJs, I need me a one-time whistle, can I meet you at such and such? A whistle? Lugo makes a finger gun. Oh, you mean a hammer? A hammer, a whistle. Lugo turns away and tightens his ponytail. The kid looks off then. I know a knife. Lugo laughs. My mother knows a knife. This one's used. Forget it. Then chin tilting to the other kid. What about your sidekick there? My cousin? He's like half retarded. How about the other half? Ah, oh, come on. The driver lolls his head like a cow. Another patrol car rolls up, this one to pick up the prisoner. All right, just think about it, okay? Lugo says. I'll see you back in holding in a few hours. What about my car? Gilbert Grape there, he's got a license? His brother does. Well, then tell him to call his brother and get his ass down here before you wind up towed. Damn. And calling out, Raymond, you hear that? The cousin nods but makes no move to retrieve his cell phone from the car hood. So you never answered my question, Lugo says, skull staring him into the rear of the cruiser. You ever been locked up before? The kid turns his head away, murmurs something. It's okay, you can tell me. I said yes. For? The kid shrugs, embarrassed, says this. Yeah, around here? Uh-huh. How long back? On Christmas Eve. On Christmas Eve for this? Lugo winces. That is cold. Who the fuck? Do you remember who collared you? Uh-huh. The kid mutters, then looks Lugo in the face. You. I'm going to read two smaller sections. At some point, everybody's turned into Lower East Side upside down for whoever killed this kid, and he's a very mediagenic victim. You know, somebody who's an aspiring something who comes to New York with stars in his eyes and sees the Col-Col sidewalk. Blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so the whole Lower East Side is they have nothing. They can't get anything. And finally, one of the people that didn't get the message, he's not supposed to be living down there anymore. An old junkie tries a purse snatch, and when he gets grabbed, the first thing he says is, let me go and I'll tell you who shot that white kid. So, of course, they truck him down to the detective about 3 in the morning. The detective's name is Matty Clark. The other cop in the scene, his name is Iacono. He lives in a bunk room for the last 6 months, no windows. He just comes out every once in a while and shower clogs and a toothbrush and writes something down and goes back to sleep. This is 3 a.m. This city, Lester Kaufman said, one knee crossed over the other, a cuffed hand dangling languidly from the restraint bar. People are doing so well, you know, but you can't ask them for shit anymore. It's never been so bad. Matty grunted in sympathy. The bouncer had told Matty that the first thing this guy had said when he grabbed him after the attempted purse snatch in front of Berkman's was, let me go and I'll tell you who shot that white kid. I swear, man, Lester said to Matty for the 10th time in the last half hour. I just said that like in a panic, like the first thing that came into my head. What's left in my head? Unfortunately, Matty believed him. Lester yawned like a lion, revealing a dull steel ball pierced through his tongue. Iacone, roused from sleep for this, yawned in response. But I'll tell you, man, I'm really worried about my girlfriend. I gave her $100 to get me something, you know, get me well. She said 15 minutes and left me standing there 3 hours. I had no idea where she went, what happened to her 15 minutes. I mean, I never would have done that if she didn't leave me there like half the night watching everybody coming out of that restaurant for smokes, drunker and drunker, half the damn bags right on the sidewalk. Another titanic yawn, the dirty, dull tongue pierce winking. Sucks, Iacone said. Strapped for a partner, Maddie had cajoled him out of the bunk room with the promise of overtime and an easy commute. "I mean, I'm fucked, I know it, but can you just check your computer, see if she's in the system? I'm hoping she just got collared, nothing worse, but..." "What's her name?" "Anita Castro or Carla Nieves." Iacone rose and went to the computer on Yolanda's desk. "Where'd you get $100, Lester?" Maddie asked. "Where?" He shivered, then coughed into his fist. "Oh, man, you don't want to make extra work for yourself with questions like that." "No? Seriously." Maddie let it slide. "Nothing," Iacone called out. "You check Brooklyn?" Lester asked. "No, just Manhattan." "Can you check Brooklyn? She scores on South 2nd, South 3rd. No one scores in Manhattan anymore. Manhattan's dead. You guys took care of that." Lester recrossed his knees, a slice of grimy red long john peeking out between his pale blue ankle and the cuff of his jeans. "I mean, what the hell happened to her? She was going to take me to the hospital. I have fluid in my lungs." "That's no problem. We'll get someone to take you as soon as we're finished." "Nothing," Iacone called out. "She got a third name?" "She's not in the system, huh? Jesus, what do you think happened to her?" he asked Maddie. "And me here. This is a felony too, right?" "Not necessarily. It depends how you say what you say. You know, vis-a-vis sincerity, remorse." "I am remorseful. I didn't menace. I didn't threaten. I didn't say anything, what's it, terroristic?" "All right, just capture that in your statement. In fact, if you want, we can even write your statement for you. But Lester, what can I tell you that you haven't heard a million times before? You help us, we help. You think this could go down as a pet law? I picked the fucking thing up off the sidewalk. I didn't even think anybody was going to notice. When that big black guy started running after me, I was like, here, take it. I didn't even get to open the damn thing. I have no idea what was in there. Obviously, I'm not a pro at this." Now, don't get down on yourself," Iacone said from Yolanda's desk. "You know, I got to say right now, we're pretty much eating out of garbage cans, me and Anita. But a few years ago, we had us a store, like, worth $200,000. "Oh, yeah?" Maddie's turned to yawn. "What kind of store? Was like a punk boutique?" "No kidding. Can I have a cigarette? Jeez, I got to get to the emergency room." "All right," Maddie clapped his hands. "Here we go. One-time offer. Fuck the guys who shot that kid. Just give us a stick-up team. Just some names. Anybody you know works the hood. They check out. Not only do you get a pass here, but we take you to the ER, get you squared away, then we go look for your girl." "A stick-up team?" Lester shrugged, recrossed his legs, looked away. "You know, she used to use Carmen Lopez. That was like her professional name at this one place out in Massapequa. She's a bar dancer, very good, very popular, exotic, had her regulars, guys who like to see her. And she could go to their houses, some of them, borrow $30, $40, but she's 5 months pregnant now, so..." Resting his brow on the curve of his free hand. "I don't know, maybe it's time to go to jail. It's getting too hot out here, you know?" Anyways... And just one tiny further adventure of the Quality of Life Squad. One page. At 11 that evening, Gerard Mush Mashburn, 3 weeks out of Rikers, sat cuffed in the back of the Quality of Life taxi, Gehagan riding next to him, Daly and Lugo up front. When Daly slipped on the baseball glove wedged between the dashboard and the window and absently started pounding its pocket, Mush piped up, "You gotta put some tongue oil in that thing." "Put what?" Daly twisted around. "Oh, fuck me," Lugo grinned through the rearview. "We got Field of Dreams back there." "Knew a shortstop in high school? Used bacon grease," Mush said. "Now that was a glove with some flex to it." "You a ball player, Mush?" Gehagan asked. "Was. Left field, right, first, second, you name it, I played it. Junior year, made all-county honorable mention." "No kidding, what county?" "Chemung in upstate. And we had some ball players around there." "So how'd you go from that to this?" Daly mimed shooting up. Mush looked out the window, shrugging. "Why ask why?" "You want to come play for Quality of Life?" Lugo asked. "We'll light some big bats this year." "Yeah, that would be good. Make a team out of your collars," Mush said. "You put your snatch and grabbers around the horn. You know, good hands, quick on their feet. Strong arm boys in the outfield. And yeah, killer behind the plate. Get the batters all distracted and shit." The cops beamed at each other, chucking thumbs at the joker in the back seat. Seeing this, Mush warmed to his audience, just a trace of anxiety in the unconscious and repetitive flick of his tongue. "Now, just make sure none of your sideline coaches are substance abusers, you know, base runners trying to read all that scratching and nodding. Don't know whether to shit, piss, or wind their watch." The cops were straight out howling now, bucking in their seats with glee. "Now, the pitcher, he could be a problem. Give me a minute here." "No, I got that one," Lugo said. seeking Mush's eyes through the rear view again. You know who'd be perfect? Anybody you call tonight could bring us a gun. Thank you. Thanks. So, it's like an EST meeting, except you have to go to the mic.
And this last week's New Yorker extolled you mightily. Did you read it by chance?
Yeah. Wait, let me think.
You're consistent. What do you think about his suggestion that you leave your genre behind and write the great literary masterpiece?
Well, I don't consider myself a genre writer as such. I mean, he was talking about, you know, like I sort of boxed myself into the notion of a police procedural. But for me, it's like I have a very complicated landscape here like I did in Clockers, and I'm just trying to find a way, a narrative spine. You know, they say a crime is a lazy man's way to a plot, and it's true, and I didn't know how else to write about such a Byzantine turf as the Lower East Side. So, I hooked up behind a homicide, and wherever police go, whatever the next logical step is, you know, you take the story there, and, you know, if this kid got murdered in a botched robbery, then you look at your pattern reports, and you see, well, have there been any other, you know, robberies of this nature in the neighborhood, and then you look up the victims, and you go out and re-interview them to get an possible. So I'm thinking, great. So I wind up being able to give two voices to the Chinese in the neighborhood, and I threw in an Israeli for good luck, you know. But as I follow the progression of what do you do next, it was just a very efficient way to, you know, avoid a travelogue. You know, it's feeling like Marlon Perkins for a while, you know, but... What can I tell you? You know, you write what you write. I mean, I'm not going to not do it just to show somebody I don't have to do it, you know. Otherwise, I'll write a book on a Spanish Armada, you know. And you know, the only concern I have about that New Yorker piece is that picture of me. So, it's like even I wouldn't have sex with me. You know. Anyways.
Hi, Rich.
How you doing, Howard?
How much cooperation can you get from the police when you're pretty critical of the brass?
Well, I'm not hanging out with the brass. You know, it's like my notion of like writing about the Civil War. I'm more interested in the conversation between the pickets than I am the guys in the general's tent. You know, if you want the general's tent, you watch The Wire. You know, that'll take you to the state assembly. But no, the guys I were with actually coaching me. Because I haven't met a cop who wasn't a complainer. You know, they could be like a million other noble things, but, you know, they complain like hell. You know, it's just, in the book, it's just like there's a detective, and he's got a body. And it hit the newspapers right away. And the minute it hits the newspapers, the mayor's calling, in a bad way, because they haven't solved, the mayor's calling the police commissioner saying, what the hell are you doing to me? You know, you're my appointee. The police commissioner calls the precinct commander and say, what the hell are you doing to me? The precinct commander calls his squad, you know, the guy running the squad, you're killing us, you know, and then the squad guy is yelling at the guy who's squatting over the body, you know, wrap it up, pull the plug, you know, and the guy's trying to work and, you know, solve a mystery here, and he's got eight people on his back, and that's just the nature of it. That's just the nature of corporate America, I think, you know, and it's about higher up you go, the more your job is about keeping your job, and you keep your job by making the guy above you happy, and the guy below you keeps his job by making you happy, and it's just... But the cops they couldn't wait to complain, you know. You know, they complain about that, I complain about something, so. So Howard and I grew up together. We were in elementary school together on the same projects.
Thanks, Rich.
God, he looks so old and I look so young. I don't care.
Since you introduced your friend, I'll ask you a question about your childhood and that. I remember way in the late 70s in the Times you talked about like when you come from a family that's working its way up into the middle class, they don't encourage you to have careers in sort of creative endeavors. It's
right.
Get something that's real stable and stuff like that. So at what point did your family think you did all right?
Well, what he's referring to is I always felt like, you know, if you grew up and your parents are you know, sort of working class and they're kind of haunted by the Depression and you go away to college and they're paying and you announce you want to be a poet. And, you know, it's like they look at you like, what do we do? You know, why do you hate us? You know, But, you know, they gave me the go-ahead to go to a writing program for graduate school, but I still felt like I had to ask permission. I still just wanted to be, like, a, you know, responsible adult. When the book came out, I remember my father, the first book, The Wanderers, came out, my father said, yeah, I read it. It was okay. It wasn't, like, a good book or anything, you know. And I just, and I'm thinking, it's okay, all right. And then the next, about 4 in the morning, I you know, I get up. Ah! You know, it's like you fell asleep under a sun lamp, you know, and it's like you don't get it at first. I mean, they were pissed at me because I had a shot as a management trainee for Blue Cross out of college, and they offered me a position, and I just wanted to go to the writing program. And so when it was obvious that I was doing okay, they just kept apologizing. They said, we didn't know. And I don't know how they were supposed to. I didn't know. I mean, how was anybody supposed to know? It was going to work out okay. But I'll also tell you one last thing about that Up From the Project stuff, which is when I went away to college in upstate New York, I developed a Bronx accent worse than I've ever had in the Bronx, because it was this idea of holding on to your personality and your persona, and, you know, when you're feeling kind of overwhelmed by your environment. I mean, I knew Southern guys that sounded like the Snopes, but in fact, you know, went to Yale and, you know, but they never had, you know, those Mississippi accents back home. One guy, his father was the headmaster of a private school. But when The Wanderers came out, and they really pushed that working class, the dark side of the American, so my Bronx accent kept getting worse and worse and worse. And finally, I did a talk or a reading somewhere at, like, Fordham University or somewhere in the Bronx. And at the end of the reading, this like, middle-aged, probably 20 years younger, but he was, like, this gray-haired construction, I was 24, and this gray-haired construction worker comes up to me, and he says, you're from the Bronx? I said, yeah. I said, you went to Cornell, right? I said, yeah. You know, I thought he was going to say, oh, I can't believe it. And then he says, that's fascinating. You know why? I said, because my daughter goes to Bronx Community College, and she speaks better fucking English than you. and that was the end of my D's, Dem, Do's. Anyways, I'm sorry.
I wonder if you could say something about how you approach writing screenplays and how you approach writing novels in terms of...
Well, whatever I'm doing, I wish I was doing the other. You know, that's one irreversible fact. If I know. Screenplays, you're writing for a two-dimensional form. You're writing for a flat screen. It's all people say things, people do things. It's all about what the eye and the ear take in. Novels are four-dimensional. You got the interior life of the characters. Plus, you've got this thing called writing. There's no writing in a screenplay. A screenplay is a 120-page memo to a director. Do this, do that, do this, do that. And that's basically what it is. They couldn't be more opposite of each other. I think the best screenwriter makes the worst novelist. This stuff would be so superficial and thin. And the best novelists make terrible screenwriters because their stuff is static and turgid. Because it's not about the eye. It's not about movement, you know. And it's to the credit of each that they're bad in the other. You know, I think every major American writer has at least one screenplay locked in a drawer, and it should stay there. You know, because it probably reads like a novel, you know. But where I get in trouble is with screenplays, because all I have is words, so I'll have people talk too much. Because I'll watch a movie like, what was I saying, the one There Will Be Blood, There Shall Be Blood or something. And it was a riveting movie, and I watched the first 10 minutes of it, and it was like 3 words of dialogue. I said, what the hell would I do for that movie like that? You know, I'm not a filmmaker, you know.
Thank you.
So, yeah.
With regards to The Wanderers and Clockers, are you happy with the way they came out in film?
No, but who cares? You know, it's like I didn't make the film, I wrote the book. You know, you take the check, don't complain. Honestly. I mean, at first, you know, you go in there and you get all nuts and everything. You know, oh, no, strike's not like that. You know, it's a movie, you're not the author anymore, the director's the author, you know. And at this point, I just assume they're going to do something that is not what I had in mind, but what I had in mind is a novel. So just because I don't have it in mind doesn't mean... Listen, a lot of writers become directors because they get so crazy about what's done to their work. But frankly, I'd probably be worse than the guys I hate. You know, so what can I say, you know? I'm a writer. I know I'm a writer. I'm not a filmmaker.
Thank you. Before I came out tonight, I was flipping through Ladies' Man, and it made me think to ask you, you know, that's a book about, like, one character. You follow him out on his kind of his excellent adventure, his identity crisis, whatever, just him. And your last few books have been these sort of wide scopes, the Lower East Side, the City of Dempsey. Do you ever have an attraction to going back to you know, kind of a focus more like
those. I don't know. It's not like I don't have like a master plan. It's like whatever hits me when it hits me is what I'll do. I you know, but it's like falling in love. It's like, you know, it has to like come at me. And I don't know. I'm in my second job now selling the book. But I tell you, the big difference between like Ladies Man and Clockers is not just it's like one person, you know, on a journey through whatever versus like a big panorama, is that up until my first four books, I thought the only thing I could write about are things I personally experienced. And when you have four books and you're 32, I mean, even your therapist is going to weep with boredom, you know. I couldn't write anymore. I didn't know what else to write about. What am I going to write about? My breakfast? You know, it's like... But I didn't know what to do, so I started doing screenplays because I figured as a pen for hire, I would keep writing, but without the pressure of, you know, having to make, you know, some authorial statement about life. And I did that for about 8 years. And what I learned in screenwriting, usually you're supposed to, like, crap all over it, but frankly, what I learned in screenwriting was that you can go out and learn about people and things that have nothing to do on paper, you know, with your life. And then if you have enough empathy and wit, I mean, you can bring it home and you can write about the world. There's a whole world out there, you know. And sometimes the way, you know, you want to find yourself, lose yourself, you know. And this screenplay kind of liberated me from thinking, okay, I had a kid. Now I got to write about having a kid. Oh, had another kid. Here comes, you know, it's a third kid. It's a trilogy, you know. Kid's a midget. It's a novella, you know. you know, but it was very liberating for me. I mean, I really enjoyed writing Ladies Man, but the stuff I'm doing now, it's like, if I have writing students, I'm in my class, I tell them to go write something. So, you know, it's like Thanksgiving break, so they write about how their dorm stinks and their roommate has got this acne, I can't look. And I go home and I hate my parents and the girl I was, went to the prom with is screwing some other guy, you know. It's like, and they run out of steam after about two pages and they're right. They're all staring at their navel, you know. It's like, well, you can make shit up. It's called fiction, you know. It doesn't have to be your biography over and over and over again. Anyways, so I guess that's it. All right, thank you.
Thanks for joining us on Book Tour. For more readings and discussions like this one, please visit npr.org/booktour.